Welcome to Canucks Central at Noon. Your Vancouver Canucks live here.
Drops off for Horvat, back to Edler, then to Horvat at the slot. He scores! Bo Horvat in overtime!
On the home of hockey, Sportsnet 650.
Landeskog turned it over to Horvat, right to the slot. Pettersson scores! Is there anything this kid can't do?
Here's Scott Rintoul and Mick Nizar.
Game day. Vancouver Canucks, Arizona Coyotes. Yeah, it's a big one. Tonight here at Rogers Arena. Is it going to be a three-point game? Is this another nail in the Coyotes' coffin tonight? Can the Vancouver Canucks snap out of a three-game losing streak? Can they be the team they have been most of the year on home ice? All questions we will explore throughout the course of this hour. And oh yeah, how does that little announcement from the NHL today factor into the Vancouver Canucks moving forward? The salary cap is moving on up. Scott Rintoul, Mick Nizar, we're live at Rogers Arena where we await news on Quinn Hughes that will not come for a number of hours. Everybody wondering yesterday, will he play, won't he? Did not take the optional skate today. Tyler Myers did, but Tyler Myers stayed out there a really long time. Read into it what you will. What do you read into it, sir?
To me, that kind of indicates that he would still be out. That's just to me, or...
He being Tyler Myers?
Yes, Tyler Myers, just because of the extra skate. And look, they're both going to be game-time decisions, but, you know, if something's out of the ordinary from a normal game day schedule, that, you know, that to me is the outlier. Someone being absent for an optional skate is not an outlier. A guy staying out afterwards, to me, is a kind of an indicator of that, you know, you're putting in extra work because you're not working later tonight.
Here's what we do know about the D-Corps tonight. We know that Stetcher's going to play.
Mm-hmm.
We know that Tanev's going to play. We know that Edler is going to play. Jordy Benn.
Confirmed with you.
Is going to play. Where does he fit exactly? We're not quite sure. We'll wait and see. Fanberg also left the optional skate relatively early. So if you want to do the math and deduce your own conclusions, based on what you just said and what I just told you about Jordy Benn telling me he's been told he is in the lineup tonight, a guy who can play either side.
This feels like a math problem. It's like, well, this X variable, and you got to switch it over to the other side of the equation.
Well, where it leads you is, look, if you believe Quinn Hughes didn't need to take the optional skate, looked good enough skating on his own yesterday, and will play tonight, it leads you to believe that Tyler Myers sits, Ben is in, Fantenberg is in, Hughes and Tanev, Edler, Stetcher, that's how it all rolls out. Isn't that what it leads you to believe?
Yes.
And that Jordy Benn plays for the first time on his offside this season?
Tonight, yes. That to me is what...
That's the logical conclusion here. We can wait and see, and maybe Quinn Hughes doesn't feel right when he gets down to the rink and goes out there for pregame warm-up. That's certainly a possibility. But that's the conclusion it leads me to.
It feels like the most obvious. And look, this is also the benefit of having a guy like Jordy Benn who's able to do that. It's in his skill set. That may not be what Travis Green wants always. He likes to have the guys on the same side of their hand. But if that's the option and he's confirmed he's in, the easiest path to get in feels like it's going to be on the right side with Tyler Myers putting in the extra work again. If that's where the path we're going down, it feels like he would be on the third pairing on the right side.
We'll see where it all comes out. Bottom line, Demko is in net. There's the guy that really needs the confidence boost tonight. He is playing an Arizona Coyotes team that is capable of scoring goals in bunches on a couple of times over the last couple of weeks, but for the most part, Bick doesn't have a lot of offense. It's one of those games stylistically that should set up well for preventing goals against, because Arizona just doesn't score that many. Now, hey, they had 5 against Buffalo on the weekend. Wasn't that long ago they scored 7 against Tampa Bay, but there's a lot of 1s and 0s and 2s on box scores that involve the Arizona Coyotes.
I've been watching their games a lot recently, and it feels like they're not the same team that we applauded in November and December. It's just, like, not as clean hockey. Like, they're still structurally sound. They're still, you know, tough to penetrate and get goals on, obviously, but just how they transition the puck, I don't think some of the players that they wanted to develop have taken as much of a step as they wanted. And I think in a night like tonight, how you forecheck is going to be really important. Can you create turnovers off of a team that, you know, doesn't move the puck as cleanly as you would think? A team that's so well coached is. Because I think they are well coached and they are tough to break down, but offensively they still struggle.
They were so good at winning tight hockey games a year ago, and they got over almost every single time. That hasn't been the case this season with the Arizona Coyotes, and it's a place you thought they would have thrived. Their winning percentage in one-goal hockey games this year, second worst in the NHL. Given the style they play and how successful they were at it last season, I think that would come as a surprise to a lot of people. Only Ottawa is worse in one-goal hockey games as far as winning percentage goes. Yeah, Arizona is 11, 11, and 8.
But those numbers, like, we know they're volatile.
Of course.
We know they swing from year to year.
Sure, but I think most people, when they think of the Arizona Coyotes and they think of the way they play hockey, that they would be fine in those situations. And often what those come down to, goaltending. This isn't all on Antti Raanta because he came back, and recently he's been very good. But they went through a period when they lost Darcy Kuemper where they just weren't getting enough saves.
Yeah, and I think it's Kuemper tonight that's been confirmed. Yeah, so to live and die by, though, that close game mentality, like, that's the dangerous thing. That's why we talk about, can you continue to put pressure on in third periods when you have leads or in tight games to try to create a gap, right? It's important to have, like, that one-goal lead and not fall into the collapsing style defense and trying to play the game that way. You can be as concrete defensively as you want to, but, like, we saw it here recently. That Minnesota game, a puck goes off someone's face and it goes in. If you invite pressure, that's how goals are created. That's how chances are created.
You made this point early in the season, and it's a good one because we focus on that one goal record. A lot of close games in this league and a lot of goals that go beyond regulation. And you get the loser point. And when we looked at the Canucks record last year, they had, what, lost 25 of 42 games that were one-goal games, and we said, hey, you got to improve in that department. And you said, yeah, the way you improve in that department is don't play as many one-goal games.
Yeah.
Don't play as close games in a sport where random bounces often dictate the outcome.
And that's a mentality thing. That's not a, hey, let's just, in a close game, let's just try to preserve this one goal. That's a, we're going to play a similar style as we've done to get our lead. We are going to create a system that allows us to be consistent. And that's the thing that's so, you know, we talk about that Columbus game. They played really well for 52 minutes. And if they kept that going, you seal that game. And then for a brief moment, they got out of it. And that went to a cascading set of issues that you look back and you say, oh, if they just continued who they were, that's a two-goal game. No problem. And can you be... The big issue there is consistency.
Yes, can you replicate the start tonight? Can you replicate the clean hockey where you're not taking penalties? Can you replicate tidy defensive zone coverage, which at times this year has been an issue for this hockey team? Can you replicate those tonight? And if so, can you do it for 60 instead of 52? That's the challenge that lies ahead. I said earlier in the show, that's the hardest thing to do in sports, not just game to game, season to season. Replicating success. Any team, any player can have one good year. Can you do it again? And can you do it again after that? And it's the same with game to game. Hey, it's great that you had one good game. Can you do it for most of 82? And that's what separates the teams we talk about beyond April and the teams that we say, where are they coming up in the lottery simulator?
Yeah. It's what's fascinating, too, is the young players on this team, I feel like, are becoming more consistent. I know we've talked about Pettersson, and there's been some lack of production, but he's still in all the right places. And
still point-of-game guy.
Yeah.
63 points in 64 games.
It's fine, right? I'm not too concerned. It'd be a bigger issue if there was no chances. So he's still putting himself in the right places, and he's going to have a multiple Columbus-style games where he puts up 3 points. But those players, to me, have found consistency. And that's why you can be high on this team, because the leaders, at least statistically, and the ice time, they are becoming more consistent. Quinn Hughes, we keep talking about, when's he going to hit that wall? And there's been the odd blip here of a bad game like Montreal, but by and large, he's been consistent. It's the rest of the roster that has become concerning, that lower down the lineup, those players haven't lived up to their consistent expectations.
Scott Rento, Bick Nazar, you want in on the conversation? Subway text message inbox is 650-650. We've talked a lot about the road to 94. We haven't labeled it that completely, but the road to 94, which is the safe zone. We've kind of determined that number is where you feel safe. You're probably not going to need 94 points to get into the playoffs, but if you're below 94 points, you're going to sweat a little bit. If you're 92, 91, 90, late 80s, now you're leaving it up to everybody else as opposed to taking care of your own business. The road to 94 for the Canucks right now looks like this. The easiest way, 10-7. Now, that doesn't look like world-beater hockey.
No.
And when you consider the Canucks have 10 home games left of their final 17, that feels fairly achievable. Does it not?
For sure.
You can get in with the lower point total, but you're sweating.
And I think they're on pace right now for exactly 94. I think it's like 93.4 or something like that. So they're around that range to get to 94 points. And look, that's 10-7. Is that like that would be slightly above what they're playing at so far? Because there's what 30? My math is terrible. 34 points available, and they need 20 of those. So yeah, it's doable, but it's also in relation to all the other teams, like Nashville losing.
If you're a playoff team, 10-7 should be doable.
Yes.
Yes, you're right. Nashville is a big one, and the crazy part of Nashville losing is Minnesota Wild getting right back in there.
But again, they also have games in hand on Minnesota. We keep talking about this. Yeah, one game in hand, sorry, on Minnesota. We keep talking about how close it is, yes, but with the games play discrepancy, like we also have to appreciate that of how much of a difference there is. One, you can build that cushion, and once we're all even on games, what does it look like then?
Fair enough, and yet you've heard me repeat this time and time again. Games in hand are great if you use them. Mm-hmm. Canucks had a couple last week that they didn't use. Ottawa was a game in hand on everybody. Mm-hmm. Everybody was watching. That didn't go particularly well. I'm not saying it's all doom and gloom, but you can't just rely on those. Oh, hey, they have two games in hand. That's 4 points. Not necessarily. Good on the Oilers. They used their games in hand, and they picked up 4 points over the last 2 days. And now Edmonton finds itself in a spot where sub-500 hockey will get Edmonton to 94 points all of a sudden. They just have to go 7-8 the rest of the way to get there. But you look at the stark contrast with the team who comes here tonight. Arizona wants to get to 94. That's 11-4 the rest of the way. That is a heater.
That's too tough. And that's what we keep talking about in relation to the other teams of, like, Arizona, tonight is pretty much make or break for them.
Well, this four-game stretch feels like it, doesn't it?
But if you lose this one, because Vancouver's in the wild card spot, they're probably chasing that or Pacific Division 3. And if Vancouver wins tonight, they leapfrog Calgary and all of that.
Well, unless Calgary wins tonight.
Right. Yes. But it becomes too tough if you're 4 points back and you've played the most games amongst everyone. It's
Hey, we've seen crazier things. Yeah. You can get on a heater at any time, but you start running out of margin.
At some point, you keep trying to hope you hit the hot hand fallacy of like, oh, yeah, we can go 13-0. It's too difficult.
Vancouver, Calgary, Winnipeg, Vancouver. Those are the next four games for the Arizona Coyotes. It feels like a season-defining stretch. If that is middling, boy, is it going to be tough. You start to get hot right now, and you pick up 7 of these next 8 points, 8 points, somehow you get on a four-game roll. Okay, now Arizona has played itself right back into the mix it thought it was going to be in, but they don't have a lot of time left. Canucks fans feel the same way. The math indicates they have a little more margin for error, but home ice, start taking care of some of your own games because Colorado comes calling on Friday. That will be a tougher test. Shouldn't be any motivation problem on Sunday against the Columbus Blue Jackets given what happened this past week. And you get the idea, though.
And those three Arizona games that you're talking about, the first three, all on the road, right? Vancouver, Calgary, Winnipeg. They're already playing from behind, but it's tougher to win on the road.
They are a perfect NHL 500 on the road. They are 15-15-4.
Yeah, but just in general.
Like, I'm just telling you, they're not great. They're not a great road team. It's not like the Flames, who've been an excellent road team this year and probably right now would prefer to go on the road given the way their home schedule has gone. In fact, Calgary made me look yesterday. Calgary has 14 wins on home ice. And I went, okay, what is the bare minimum home ice wins you need to get into the playoffs? And I found two teams in the last, I want to say, 10 to 12 years in the Western Conference that only had 18 home ice wins and somehow found their way into the playoffs.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's
– San Jose 1 year had a sub-500 home ice record but was 28-10-3 on the road and got into the playoffs.
Yeah, that's stunning. It's too difficult a burden to overcome.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it comes to what the Canucks are doing, yeah, this homestand is – It can't be underscored. It's they keep using mulligans, and they've survived because other teams have been on losing streaks. But this is a time when you've got to get back to one of those winning streaks. The season keeps coming down to these streaks that they put themselves in these positions, and then they overcome it, and suddenly they're in Pacific Division 2 seed, and everything looks fine and good, and then they go on a 3-game losing streak, and here we are talking about them potentially being outside of the playoff picture in a few days. They have to get back to a streak. And if they play like they have been the last two games, there is a streak coming. But it comes down to goaltending. It keeps coming back to that. It's great that the team plays well, the 18 skaters. If there's a loose goal, that becomes an issue.
Thatcher Demko, the good news, he's been far better at home than on the road this year. He's been very comfortable in these confines. Maybe he finds his mojo once again tonight. Last time he played, of course, was against the Toronto Maple Leafs, Hockey Night in Canada, on Saturday. Scott Rinto, Bick Nizar, you just used the word mulligans, and that comes up because of the announcement out of Florida today, at least to a certain degree.
Right.
This does not fix the Vancouver Canucks salary cap. But what the news of the salary cap going up today does is give Jim Benning and every other GM around this league the flexibility that they, you know, previously, especially this past season, had to carve out for themselves, and in some cases couldn't do it. This could only be $2.5 million of cap relief, but it could be almost $7 million of cap relief relative to this year. And you wonder how it changes the way they look at certain signings moving forward based on the number that comes in. It's going to go up to at least 84. It could go to 88.2. This year, the salary cap is 81.5. This doesn't fix everything, but it gives you the flexibility that every general manager craves.
I would also shade closer to 84. That's just the way I look at it. I can't imagine it goes up to 88.2.
No, I doubt that both parties exercise a 5% inflator.
Yeah.
I could see it being 84, 85, 86, one of those three numbers.
If I was a GM today, yes, you get that nice, healthy range, but I'm still planning as if it's between 84 and 85.
We saw this last year. Yes. Very few GMs, or not enough GMs anyway, looked at it as being 81.5. They thought they were going to be around 83.
Yes.
And $1.5 million doesn't sound like much. It makes a big difference.
It's huge. And the other thing that happened last year is the number came in so late. Hopefully, you get the number earlier this year. But also, from the Canucks' point of view, like, let's just operate in this conversation that it's $84 million. Yes, some cap space opens up. We also have to remember, like, there's some overage charges that are coming next season with Elias Pettersson, with Quinn Hughes, who have hit their Class A entry-level contract bonuses. So, yes, you're getting cap space, but some of it's going to get taken away immediately because of those charges, which, because they don't have cap space this season, it's not going to get credited to this season. It gets moved over to next year. And the other conversation we've had about cap space is, okay, the space may not be there, but are you flexible enough to it? And are there resolutions coming? The most notable one being Louis Erickson. Like, that's $6 million that if a natural resolution presents itself, is $6 million coming off completely? Is it going down to Utica where only $1 million comes off? What are the solutions that his contract could present? I don't see a version where he's on this roster next year.
Nor do I, but I also didn't think Louis Erickson would play games this year. I took the L on that a long time ago, and that materialized. I didn't think we were going to see that this season, so I'm not going to put anything out of the realm of possibility next year. But, yeah, it feels more likely than not. We'll see how it goes. These questions come into the Subway text message inbox. Do you know when Luongo's contract is off the books? Thanks, Dex. Yeah, 2 more years.
Yeah.
They got that for 2 more years. In Vancouver. Duncan says, I guess we can offer Jacob more. Maybe. And this comes down to philosophy as much as anything else. Does it change Markstrom's ask whatsoever? Does it change the Canucks' ceiling whatsoever? I can't answer either of those questions because I don't know unequivocally what the Canucks' philosophy is when it comes to their goaltending application on the cap.
Well, and I've made this example to you before. If you want to go back to a previous example, Ryan Miller's contract. Like, there was that action of signing that goalie to that style of contract says, hey, we actually do value what the goaltender position brings, and we want to pay a certain amount for it. So if you go back to how much that contract was, it was just shy of 9% of the cap. Apply that. I'm not saying he's going to get that, but apply that to an $84 million cap. That's $7.31 million. Now, is Jacob Markstrom going to get $7 million? I would be skeptical of that. So now you can work backwards from there.
And really, this is about less about just the goaltender, I would argue, and more about the goaltending position.
Yes. Again, precisely. This isn't about Jacob Markstrom. It's just how do you allocate the dollars to build a team. Now, at some point, Jim Benning felt that I can give nearly 9% of the cap to a goaltender and be competitive. So that just gives you a framework of what how this team can be constructed. And again, I don't think it's going to be that much, but that shows you if we suggest it's, I don't know, you know, like what's a fair number that we think for Jacob Markstrom? Like 6.2, and that's probably being aggressive? Is that?
Yes, and that has as much to do with the goaltending market as anything else.
Yes.
Yeah, there's lots of guys out there making more than that, but we saw what happened in the free agent market last summer. One guy.
So that would be around...
One guy got paid.
So that would be around like 7% of the cap. So that's less than what Ryan Miller got paid. So again, that gives you an indication, yes, you can do it, and it's probably cheaper in relation to the pie that's being taken than what they've done in the past.
The goaltending conversation this summer, yeah, it involves the Canucks, but just in the NHL in general is fascinating to me. I equate it to the quarterback discussion we are going to see in the NFL and the carousel that could unfold. Jacob Markstrom might, in fact, be the top domino. Tom Brady's the top domino in the NFL. Depending on what Tom Brady does, that's going to alter a lot of different plans around the NFL, depending on how many teams actually think they have an opportunity to sign him. Jacob Markstrom might be the guy. If he comes back and shows he's healthy and all of those things, he might be the guy, if he goes to market, that is the first domino. Now, I don't know if he gets there. I've been pretty consistent in saying I think they get something done with him. But when you look around, people assumed it was going to be Braden Holtby. Unless he goes on a playoff run this year, it's not going to be Braden Holtby. He's having the worst year of his career.
Now, the pedigree of having been a Stanley Cup winner, that might persevere and go through of, like, the value on the free agency market.
Well, he's going to get a contract. I just don't know that he would be the first option for teams looking for a goaltender.
And just because he's leaving a team, it's not as if, okay, they're goalie needy. Like, they have a guy ready. And that's what's interesting with the goalie market is how many teams are ready to spend to get a goalie. It's not that many. And that's why this musical chairs is going to happen for these handful of goalies that are all capable and all earn or deserve a big contract. But A, who's going to be the first to make a concession? And B, who's going to be the one left without a chair? It's Holtby. Like, I would expect Corey Crawford goes back to Chicago in some capacity.
Maybe.
But
we'll see.
But Robin Leonard. And then
he's the really interesting one to me.
And then obviously you got Jacob Markstrom. And also, like, how much do people value Thomas Greiss, Hudobin? If people feel like they can get Halak, Hudobin, Greiss for cheaper, well, that takes – and then you have a young guy with that. It just feels like there's too many goalies and not enough chairs.
I think Leonard is the most interesting one as it relates to the Vancouver Canucks. I'm not suggesting they're just going to say, okay, go to market and we'll see what happens. Not at all. What I do think is that when you're – figuring out your, okay, here's what we want to happen, but if that doesn't happen, what do we do next? And what do we do after that? When you're going through your priority list that way, where does Robin Leonard land for the Canucks? If Jacob Markstrom goes to market, we know for a fact the reason Leonard's not in Chicago is because of term. Leonard wanted term. Elliot Friedman reported, and he said if he got other reports, he would correct it, but he said that he heard Chicago didn't want to go past 2 years. So what does good term look like to Robin Leonard?
And like, is that an indication for the rest of the market?
I don't know. I wonder if his situation is unique. And my point is this. Does 4 years to Robin Leonard, because of the contract offers he's been given by both the Islanders and the Blackhawks in recent years, feel like 6 years to somebody else? Where he says, you know what? No one else has offered me 4 years. That's great. I'll take that. Whereas other guys might say, look, I've earned a 6-year deal. I've earned a 5-year deal. I don't know. I can't tell you exactly what Leonard's thinking, but I think he's a really interesting piece in all of this simply because of what's happened over the last 2 years with those previous teams. And he's on the verge, Bick, of going to 3 teams in 2 years and being awesome at every single stop.
Well,
awesome.
Well, 4 teams, and if he leaves, right, that would be his 4th team.
I'm saying we have evidence where he's played exceptionally well in 3 different environments. And you can't just say, ah, he's a product of the New York Islanders. Nope. Chicago's not real good defensively. He was really good there.
Yeah.
Vegas, not exactly locked down. They'll give you some chances. It's only 2 starts. Second one's the shutout. Again, I don't know how much he's going to get to play because of Marc-Andre Fleury, but he's going to have a really compelling case.
Would Vegas entertain keeping him?
I wonder. Vegas
right?
is interesting, man. They do things differently there. They really do. Nobody thought they were going to give that kind of term to Marc-Andre Fleury, and all of a sudden they did. And so that would be the biggest detriment to them keeping Leonard.
There weren't many just even predicting a trade going there. It'd be the exact opposite of the conversation here where the Canucks bet on Thatcher Demko. They kind of didn't bet on the starting goalie. They got insurance for the starting goalie and paid a price to do so, but they wanted to reinforce what they had, and they went about it a different way rather than just going at the rental D market. They decided to go acquire a goalie. I'm curious if there's a longer-term conversation that they would entertain there. But, you know, again, just to underscore the point of what guys are what teams are would be shopping for goalies. Like, Carolina would be one you think of, but they've got money – heavy money already committed to that position for next year. Like, it's basically Buffalo, Chicago,
New Jersey.
Like, there's not a lot of teams. And
Chicago's an interesting one because you don't know how much they're really willing to put toward that position moving forward. Well, you really don't.
Well, clearly, because if they're talking about a...
Like, Buffalo screams of a team that's willing to overpay for goaltending. Not to the extent that the Panthers did, but they scream of that team, don't they?
They've done some overspending in free agency in the past.
Jeff Skinner, line one.
Well, I was going to even go back to, like, Okposo and Erhoff and all that sort of stuff. But, yeah, as recently as just this past summer, yeah, Jeff Skinner is on line one.
It is a game day in Vancouver, Canucks and Coyotes tonight. Emily Kaplan, some great stuff in her ESPN columns this week, and she will join us next right here on your home of Canucks hockey, Sportsnet 650.
Now more of Canucks Central on the official home of the Vancouver Canucks, Sportsnet 650.
We know these games are important. You know, we don't want to add any extra pressure. We want to come to the rink like it's a normal game. We're excited, I think. We've done a lot of good things in the last two. We're looking forward to hopefully get a win on the board here. We know we need one. You know, it's good that we're playing these games that are closing the standings, and I think it's good for us to bring the best out of us.
If you're a believer in the old axiom that before you get on a winning streak, you lose a couple of games you should have won, then this sets up well for the Vancouver Canucks tonight against the Arizona Coyotes. I'm not sure they should have won the game against the Toronto Maple Leafs, but they should have been able to get something out of it. We don't need to go down that road about soft goals again. Obviously, in Columbus, they were the better team for the bulk of that game. Would we say 87%? Travis Green was happy with 87% of that hockey game.
That was a very specific number.
Yeah, 52 of 60.
Yes.
That was the ratio that we came up with there. Bottom line, this one tonight got a little more juice to it. It's a division rival. It's a Pac-5 battle. It's the team at the bottom of the Pac-5. It's the Arizona Coyotes. This is the team that ended the Canucks last year. Last year was about meaningful games in March. That died because of the Arizona Coyotes. 2 games, one at Rogers Arena, one down in the desert, late February, and that dream of meaningful games in March was over. Well, a year later, there are meaningful games in March. And the Vancouver Canucks have the opportunity to kill the dream of meaningful games in April for the Arizona Coyotes. They play them twice in Arizona's next 4 games.
Twice in the next 8 days.
Yep.
Get comfortable with the Coyotes, and I guess Columbus too, because they play twice in the next, or in 8 days since they played on Sunday. This is a chance for revenge to some degree, but how much are players thinking about that?
About Coyotes revenge? No, not at all.
Right?
No.
It's
a different
nice
group. They're a completely different group this year.
It's a nice point of conversation, and plus, to me, that feels like a bit low impact. If it's a playoff series, different conversation, obviously. But
I'm just saying the Canucks last year got their hopes dashed by this team. They can dash somebody else's hopes. And that's part of the conversation when you go down the stretch drive. It's just not picking up points for yourself. It's stepping on somebody when you have a chance. Because that's what ultimately you're going to have to do in a playoff series.
And that killer instinct is something this team does need to develop, as we just saw on Sunday. They've done it in some days, but it goes back to being consistent. And that's the tough part about being a youngish team. And I know they're not at fault on Sunday, but that's part of developing that instinct of where we're going to see that growth over a few years, as much as we want it within weeks.
Just four games on the NHL schedule tonight. Good one in Washington between the Caps and Flyers.
A very sneaky Flyers team, which has skyrocketed up the standings.
Yeah, six consecutive wins. Ovi looking for another goal on his way to reaching Mike Gartner 708. He's five goals back. Columbus, Calgary. Big game for the Flames, obviously. First game back home. And Columbus living on life support with all those injuries. Anaheim, Colorado. And then there is the one we were just talking about, Arizona, Vancouver. Emily Kaplan knows that and a whole lot more. She of ESPN joining us here on Canucks Central. Emily, thank you very much for doing this. How are you?
You know what? I'm doing great. I'm still in Boca Raton for the GM meeting, so just enjoying my last bit of sunshine.
Beautiful. And soak that vitamin D in. Everybody's soaking in the word from Bill Daly today that the salary cap is going up anywhere from $2.5 million to nearly $7 million if the full inflator was used by the NHL and NHLPA. Is there a team or a couple of teams that jumped out to you immediately as just so relieved to hear that news today?
Yeah, I think any of the upper spending teams are like, yeah, thank God. You know, I live in Chicago. I know the Blackhawks, knowing that they have to give out a couple big raises to guys like Dylan Strome next year, maybe Dominic Kubalik, who has 29 goals and has earned his way in. The Edmonton Oilers are going to really have some relief here. So I think there's plenty of teams happy with this. And honestly, it's just a good indication that the league is in good shape as we welcome our 32nd team in Seattle, not this year, but the year after.
Were you surprised at the numbers of 84 to 88 and also, you know, early returns, obviously, but what would be your impressions of where it ends up, closer to 84 or closer to 88?
Oh, I have no idea. That all depends on the NHLPA negotiations with them, and who knows what goes on between those talks, but I'd say it's going to be somewhere around there, and I'm not totally surprised because we have seen growth in the last couple of years. This is a little bit of a slighter increase in growth that we've seen in the years past, but look, the league is getting a ton of revenues right now. Hopefully they can keep it that way. Hopefully the playoffs go on with this coronavirus going on, and everything will be dandy.
Well, now that you bring it up, we should ask, because you did put out a piece of the contingency plans. For our listeners, what are those contingencies should this arise?
You know, I think the league is, they didn't really want to say anything on the record. I think they're very, very cautious of spreading panic before it needs to be spread. We don't quite know what this virus is going to look like in North America a month from now when the playoffs do begin. But I think everything's on the table, whether it's playing in arenas where there's nobody there, whether it's postponing games or it's canceling games. Bill Daly told me, knock on wood, he's optimistic they won't have to do anything that dramatic. And, you know, they're just going to have to defer to the health officials. And they're really following the lead of the CDC here in America and public, what's it, Health Canada? That's what you guys have. It's your equivalent. And really the local health authorities. But, you know, one thing I've thought about is, okay, if you play a playoff game in an arena where there's nobody there, how will that affect revenues? And I do know that there are insurance plans in place for individual teams and legality with the league. And I think that's something that they're exploring right now to make sure this isn't a huge financial loss for the league.
I had no idea Florida and Ottawa would be playoff venues, arenas where nobody's there.
What's fascinating, too, is it's not as if the league hasn't dealt with issues before. Like, what was a case of the mumps a few years ago, right? So this is not new to the league. They probably had contingency plans back then and are aware of what they need to do. Now, this is on a bigger scale. We're talking about arenas being empty.
Yeah, it is. And look, I they sent out a memo on Friday that had the basic things that you're probably seeing in your workplace, too. Like, hey, remind everyone, here's best practices. Make sure you wash your hands. If you're feeling sick, stay at home. I do think it's interesting that the league did ban international travel for all the league office employees. That's not individual teams. That's anyone who works either in the Toronto or New York office. And if they do come back, they have to be quarantined for 2 weeks, which is quite crazy, just to make sure that they're okay. Obviously, the big thing I would be monitoring is the May World Championships, which are supposed to be held in Switzerland. And we know that the NHL has a really big presence there, whether it's players whose teams have been eliminated, whether it's GMs going there to scout. I know a lot of guys find European treasures in that tournament. So the NHL won't put out any mandates like banning anyone from going, but they might put out recommendations if it escalates there.
Well, and this also eliminated the possibility of games in China this coming fall, did it not? And I know that that's not something every NHL fan thinks of, but that is a market the NHL consistently over the last couple of years had wanted to make sure it had its fingers on.
Yeah, so I talked to Bill Daly about it, and you know, they were there in 2017 preseason, 2018 preseason. They wanted to be there last year, but due to scheduling conflicts with arenas, they just couldn't get it firmed up. They were trying to figure it out for this preseason, and from my understanding and what Bill Daly essentially alluded to is because of this coronavirus, they just haven't been able to, you know, everything's kind of been on lockdown there. They haven't been able to obviously travel there, and they're unlikely to be able to schedule a preseason game there for the 2020-2021 season. So it's going to take another pause, although they do have a bunch of European games next year, and they're hopeful that those will go on as scheduled.
ESPN's Emily Kaplan joining us today on Canucks Central. Everybody's starting to have that Hart Trophy conversation. There's some who say, no-brainer, Leon Draisaitl. Why are we even talking about this? There are others who say, well, I'm not sure he's done the most for his team considering he plays with Connor McDavid. Where are you on that discussion?
My take on this discussion is nobody's wrong. Just because I say I think Leon Draisaitl is the front runner for the MVP, which is what I believe, doesn't mean that I think that what Nathan MacKinnon is doing in Colorado isn't impressive, or if the Rangers make it, that Artemi Panarin should be considered. But there's just this one stat that sticks out to me. Leon Draisaitl has scored or assisted on 51% of his team's goals, which is on pace to be the highest percentage by any player since Jaromir Jagr in 1998-99. And what is crazy is that Connor McDavid is second in the league at 44%. So 51%, like, that is insane. I think what he's doing is incredibly impressive. And if I were to cast my ballot today, I believe I would make Leon Draisaitl, especially because that team looks like it's in sure playoff position, and Draisaitl is one of the biggest reasons they are.
Right before you came on, we were just kind of briefly touching on a team that has kind of caught my eye since mid-January, the Philadelphia Flyers.
Yeah.
You know, this is such an impressive run. And this market's very aware of the impact Alain Vigneault can have in a short run. Just how impressed are you with what they've done in this calendar year? And also, you know, what other teams are slowly sneaking up on your radar as we head towards the playoffs?
Yeah, you know, Alain Vigneault, I don't know if he's getting enough credit. I'm pretty sure Mike Sullivan is going to win Coach of the Year. But if you consider everything Alain Vigneault has gone through this year of taking over this team, they haven't had a third-line center pretty much all year long. They get the news early in the season that one of their players has leukemia, a really young, promising ascending player. They have to deal with that, and Oscar Lindblom. They're without Nolan Patrick, and they're able to do this and become such a stouter defensive team than they were. They're very impressive to me, and they look like they're in good shape for the playoffs. Another team that I'm pretty shocked by, and I left them for dead a couple times, is the Minnesota Wild. I don't know how they're doing it. Maybe it's the Kevin Fiala effect because he finally looks like that prize prospect that he was of the Nashville Predators. But they're within, like, grasp of a playoff spot right now, which is not something I would say, you know, like right around the time that Bruce Boudreau was fired, which wasn't that long ago.
No, it wasn't. And it's interesting to bring it back to the Jack Adams for a second. We always say, okay, what's going to be the toughest trophy to hand out this year? The Jack Adams might be that. There are so many good cases to be made. You made a couple there. Dave Tippett has to be considered with what the Oilers are doing. Paul Maurice, how the heck has he held the Winnipeg Jets together this year? I don't know how, and we think they're going to fade because of injuries, how John Tortorella has the Blue Jackets where they are. There are so many candidates this season.
Yeah, I think my top three personally would be Mike Sullivan, Paul Maurice, and John Tortorella. But, like, that's arbitrary, and I'm really glad I don't have to vote on that award. That's the broadcasters.
What's fascinating, too, is, okay, we're highlighting all these great coaching examples this year. You had a good piece on Monday talking about, okay, how come we don't have more new coaches coming in? It's a lot of retread hires, and yet, again, we're waxing poetic about 6, 7, 8 coaches who have all been retreads. Is this a trend that we may see in the future that will get first-time hires?
I like to think so. Recency bias tells me no. Look, I think a lot of people after I wrote that piece pointed out This is what happens in all leagues. This is what happens in all businesses. But that doesn't mean it's okay. Since 2005, 60% of the coaches that have been hired have been coaches who have previous head coaching experience. And like everyone's like, oh, well, you know, six of the last 10 Stanley Cup winners have. Yeah, well, that's because those are the guys that are getting hired. That's the prevalence in the league. I think there's certain examples where guys do a great job on their second job. Bruce Cassidy is a perfect example of that, where maybe they weren't ready in their first coaching job. They kind of mature a bit and complement the areas that they were missing in their second go-around. At the same time, new voices are not necessarily a bad thing, and I'd love to see the NHL explore different potential streams, like European coaches, considering how international this league is going. Obviously, there's the whole Rickard Grönborg camp that believes he should have gotten a shot. But yeah, it's honestly the big thing that I was, my takeaway in that piece was just the hiring processes, where it feels like GMs, according to people who are in on these processes, like go in saying like, hey, I know exactly who I want to hire, and I might sit down with four or five people, but I've got a preferred candidate, and I'm going to go with that preferred candidate. Like, how is that a good model to be successful? Why wouldn't you want to listen to as many people as possible and pick the candidate that's best for you?
Well, it's interesting, especially given the backdrop of what's happening in New Jersey right now, where they, according to Elliot Friedman, have interviewed Mike Gillis and are going to interview others for front office positions right now. It's a good discussion, and it's one I raised based on your piece. I talked to Eddie Olchuk about this the other day, and for me, I wonder what the mechanism is, Emily, that makes this happen. Is it a general manager who looks at things differently and says, okay, I have more autonomy here than other situations. I'm going to bring in a European coach, for example. Or do we see it go toward some other sports where the players have such a great amount of power within their organization that they're able to dictate it? And you might find a team that is dominated by European players, specifically the star ones, that say, look, I'm telling you, the next guy we need is so-and-so.
It's a great question, and I think either of those are possible. I'll tell you the reason that Neil Glassberg, who is a coaching agent, who I was quoting in the piece, believes, and I believe this to be true too, is that a lot of teams are just risk averse. It's never, like, you know, we began this conversation talking about the salary cap being higher than ever. Like, NHL team has never been this valuable of an asset, and people are so nervous and there's such high turnover that they don't want to do anything that puts them at risk. And let's be honest, like hiring a European guy right now would be seen for many people as risky because it's never been done before. So that's why we see all of these coaches getting hired again and again. And, you know, Neil Glassberg brings up a good point. Is it a nice to have with NHL coaching experience? Is it a need to have? He thinks it's a nice to have, but a lot of NHL GMs and owners see it as a need to have.
But we've seen it at the executive level as well, that, you know, recently, just off the top of my head, it does feel like there's been more first-time GM hires. And, you know, does that lead to some of the fear of, okay, I'm a first-time guy, I need someone with some experience, at least on the bench level?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's just about getting guys into this league that think a little bit differently than the way guys did it before and not doing things just because that's the way it's always been done before. So, you know, the more analytically minded GMs we get in the league is better. Maybe the more European GMs. We only have Jarmo Kekäläinen right now. I think that's all a good thing, and we get some fresh blood and fresh ideas and keep evolving this league and moving it forward because it's such a great game and these players are evolving and doing great. I would love to see the front offices reflect that as well and coaches.
Get rid of groupthink. That was the theme of your piece, and it was a good one. That's why we bring you on to make us think. Emily, great stuff as always. Appreciate your time and look forward to doing this again soon.
My pleasure. Sorry for all this ambient noise. It's just this Florida wind, man. It's
enjoy it. Yeah.
Thanks, guys.
Enjoy it, man. I'm just thinking of the beach right now. I mean, it's a beautiful day in Lower Mainland.
It's
great. Gorgeous out there.
It might hit 10 degrees.
It's not beach weather. Yeah. If it's windy out there,
well, you're
it's
wearing a sweater and
down.
I'm in short sleeves. What's going on here,
dude? This might be the coldest room in the Lower Mainland right now.
You guys are very uncomfortable. I'm very fine right now.
Yeah, I don't know where you came from. I don't know if you were in a tanning bed. I'm not sure if you were in a sauna before this. I don't know why your body temperature is so high. But Lena and I have been sitting in this room at Rogers Arena, and for whatever reason, they decided to get the air conditioning going. I get it.
Soft.
Arenas are cold to begin with, but this is extra special today. Like, it's a chilly one in here today.
Maybe they're just trying to keep the temperature down because it is such a high, intense game tonight.
Maybe they'll try to do it for the Coyotes room. Cool them off a little bit, Bick. Some really good stuff there with Emily Kaplan. I did want to touch on the Senators situation before the end of this hour. The two big news stories today were the salary cap going up and getting rid of another CEO in Ottawa. You are one to use the phrase, there's never a bad time to do the right thing. There's never a wrong time, I should say, to do the right thing. And the Senators very well may have done the right thing here. It just looks weird. And the veil of mystery that it came with in the press release, where it says that it was conduct inconsistent with the core values of the Ottawa Senators and the National Hockey League. And Bettman said, that's not what you think it is. It's a shroud of mystery. And again, this is an organization we were applauding last week for just not having noise around. This guy lasted 54 days on the job.
Yes. But again, it does matter what these incidents or whatever it is that led to this dismissal.
And Bettman is basically taking us down the road of, look, this isn't personal conduct policy type of situations like we saw earlier this year with coaches. That's not what we're talking about here.
But, yeah, the Ottawa Senators, we've been praising them for not looking like this. For, you know, we've been praising them for their hockey play. Not that it's great this year, but they're clearly on a track. And we've heard nothing about the executive level and issues with the ownership. This just, it puts the focus off what's important for what Ottawa needs right now.
One of two things would appear to be true here. Either Eugene Melnyk, he just can't work for the guy, because this is the third upper-level management position that has been turned over in 26 months in Ottawa. Big-time position. So it's either that or your vetting process isn't very good.
Yeah, and that's part of the conversation we were just having with Emily as far as even head coaches. It's, do you have a narrow scope of who you intend to hire? And if you're only targeting the people that you want, you're probably not going through entire depth of available candidates. And I'm not saying this is what happened here, but let's face it, that is part of the culture of hockey, that there's rush to hire your friends. And do you have systems set up to go through exactly what you're talking about? Are you finding the best candidate, or are you just finding the candidate you want? And situations like that, you're probably bypassing the vetting process. That's the big issue.
It's a good conversation for another day, and one we can continue throughout the course of this week. We'll be talking a lot tomorrow about what happens tonight here at Rogers Arena. The program is all over it. You guys have the NorlandLimited.com pregame show coming up. What else?
Patrick Johnson, our Canucks insider, coming up at 5 o'clock. Obviously, it's a big game. We'll touch on all things Canucks.
It's a game day with OB as well. Shane O'Brien next coming up on Reach Deep. Dan Riccio, Randeep Janda on your home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.